Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, we have an open line right now for you at 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, along with our call, some interesting topics to talk about?
Yes, parents, breastfeeding, and solid foods, what's going on with feeding our kids. Very important information from the CDC.
It's been in the news, so we'll talk about it.
Very important. And chelation therapy, does it really work? Interesting data that has been published in the Journal of the AMA, and then an interesting editorial that came along with the data.
That has been a controversial topic
for decades, since the 50s.
What's our recipe?
Mango, shrimp, and brie quesadillas. I promise you, absolutely promise you, that if you try this, you will love it.
Sounds yummy to me. Our number again is 800-462-7413. Let's get to the phones now, Zorba. We welcome our first caller, a listener with us in Atlantic Beach, Florida. Hi.
Hey, how are you today?
Fine. How can we help?
I was actually listening to a show when y'all were discussing allergies, and it came to mind that it seems to me that the incidence of severe allergies in this day and age is much more prevalent than when I was young. I'm 60 years old now, and when I was in elementary school, so about 8 years old or so, the automatic go-to plan at school cafeteria was to dole out peanut butter sandwiches whenever a kid showed up at school without his lunch. And nowadays, everybody's so afraid of passing out peanuts due to severe peanut allergies. The airlines don't offer them anymore, and certainly if they were doling out PBJs at the school cafeterias to kids, we'd have kids dropping like flies. So I wondered if y'all had any opinion on increased incidence of severe allergies.
Dropping like flies, yeah. That's exactly it. You know, until you mention this, I do quite a lot of travels because I speak around the country. I hadn't thought about it. They don't pass out peanuts anymore. They pass out pretzels or Chex Mix, and they have given up peanuts. I hadn't thought about that. And you're right. A school that would give PB&J if a kid arrived late might get a suit from a parent saying, my child suffered from your PB&J. Why did you give them? And you are correct. Hit it right on the head, spot on. There is more food allergy now than there ever was before. And in fact, there's a lot of allergy, not just food allergies, seasonal allergies, and a whole bunch of other things. And peanut allergy is on the rise. Yeah.
Why is this happening? Do you have any idea?
Well, there are a couple of theories. First of all, the first theory that is the theory I ascribe to is called – goes under various names, but I would call it we are being too sanitary theory. So the theory is we were brought up, you know, we were hunters and gatherers, and we have an antibody system in our body that was basically made to fight disease. And so little kids that were in the cave ate dirt. They ate dirt, and they came around a bunch of other bacteria and things, and they developed an immunity. And we have brought up our children in such a sanitized environment that we have made our immune system that's all ready to go, revved up and ready to go, so awful that it actually gets ready to go against ourselves. And so we start to develop all of these immune response issues – eczema, seasonal allergies, food allergies, and peanut allergies. And so one theory is that we're raising our kids the wrong way, and they're not coming into contact with enough bacteria, and so they develop these allergies. And that's basically the most likely explanation that I feed to. Peanut allergy has actually been around for a long time, but it's and people kind of ignored it, but it has become much, much more of a problem, among other things, because peanuts are pretty much in – I don't want to say pretty much in everything, but in lots of processed foods, peanuts are used, or the processing machine used peanuts before that. Do you have food allergies yourself?
No.
No, so what is that? What?
Cats and hay fever.
But you are correct. Years ago, they didn't pay attention to it, and it was not as much of a problem now. But you're right. We're raising our kids in the wrong environment. It's too sanitary. If you have, well, you're 50. You might have children or grandchildren. Get them to make sure they're not too sanitary and they're not using too much Purell, and let them play in the dirt when they're young, because I think that's the right way to raise kids.
Thank you.
Sure.
You're
we
welcome.
Appreciate the call. Thanks. 1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. 800-462-7413.
Now, Zorba, a listener with us in Kiowa, Kansas. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, recently my wife put my family on a no grains whatsoever diet.
Mm-hmm.
Just wondering what the science is behind that. She said something about the phytic acid preventing the absorption of essential minerals and that the whatever's in the grain spikes your insulin and the gluten is bad for you and all this stuff. And I've given up sandwiches, and I want to know why.
Well, how long have you been on this diet?
About a month now.
Yeah. How are you doing on it?
Fine. And it doesn't seem to affect me all that much.
Oh, really?
As long as she does all the cooking, because it's a real pain to do cooking with no grains.
It's a pain to do cooking with no grains, and it's hard to eat that sandwich without bread or something to hold it between. The Earl of Sandwich, who invented the sandwich, supposedly, according to rumor, would certainly have a fit when it comes to this. Well, let's talk a little bit about grains.
Mm-hmm.
One of the issues that has come up is our wheat allergies. And they're kind of the hot topic and the hot issue right now. You know, you go into many, many restaurants and they'll say, well, we have gluten-free spaghetti and gluten-free this and gluten-free that. First of all, there are a number of people that are gluten intolerant. There's no doubt about it. There are a number of people that are severely gluten intolerant, small number, no doubt about it. And sometimes it's been hard to sort of figure out gluten intolerance. We know with blood tests that really help with that. And so there's been a whole movement to the fact that, well, we shouldn't be eating as much wheat, and wheat isn't everything. And so you have a group of people that are now, that are vegan, gluten-free vegans. And so what happens is, at least in my mind, is that we're painting ourselves into a corner where we're not eating a variety of foods that Mother Nature has. And I think the idea of removing something from your diet, such as grains, is really the wrong way to go. I mean, it's let's throw out the baby with the bathwater. I mean, it's that sort of a stuff. I think that to discover if wheat is the issue, which is one of the grains, you know, you remove wheat from the diet, you put it back in, you remove it, you put it back in, you see how you feel. Or you get a blood test from your doctor to see if you really have gluten intolerance. There's a blood test that's really good on screening for this. But to then remove all the grains in the diet, I think is just overkill.
Part of the argument, though, Zorba, is that wheat ain't what it used to be. Grains ain't what they used to be, that they've been so genetically modified now that they aren't as healthy for us or may not be healthy for us at all as they used to be.
Well, certainly it's quite interesting. Certainly grains, wheat, and the way it's developed, you know, we now have wheat that's developed, obviously, through either hybridization or genetic modification. Mm-hmm. And we know genetic modification has occurred in soybeans. I'm not sure which wheat products have it, if they have it or not, but certainly through hybridization. But it doesn't mean that the grains and the foods that we had years ago were better. They were just what we had years ago. I mean, it doesn't mean that they
but
were better years
everything
ago.
Everything was better years ago.
I mean, right. That's looking back, right. The good old days. The good old days, you know, when we lived to the age of 32 and then we died, you know, were not necessarily better and they weren't necessarily more nutritious. So, you know, that's what it is. But I don't think there's any evidence that a grain-free diet is going to be better. And if you're raising children, a variety of foods are good. And going back to previous discussions that I've had, once we remove foods from our diet, I think we're less likely to process a whole bunch of other things. And I believe in the robustness of Mother Nature. So I would recommend to your wife, you should say to her, in the way that a husband talks to the wife or a wife talks to the spouse, darling, show me the science. Now, I don't know how you say that, but that's what I would say. And it's got to be good science, not junk science. There's a lot of junk science out there and there are lots of websites out there that are junk. So what are you going to do?
Well, I'll probably just continue to eat no grains.
Let's see. My wife's view on one hand, Zorba's view on the other hand. Let's see how that balances out.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. So, Zorba, let's talk now about parents introducing their babies to solid foods, they say, way ahead of time.
Way ahead of time. Now, there are a number of organizations, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Family Physicians, and a number of other organizations that have come down and said, breast is best. Mm-hmm. So if we repeat that mantra, breast is best, we also say, for how long? And the answer is 6 months. That's the best thing. Now, can all women breastfeed for 6 months? Well, you know, it's hard with FMLA. You often get 3 months. And so there are issues with breastfeeding. And so what happens is a number of parents, then often moms, stop breastfeeding. And then lo and behold, 40% of the moms are introducing solid foods at 4 months. And that is too soon.
Yeah. Tell us why.
Well, because a number of things. First of all, kids may choke on the food. That's one issue that's very important. They're not ready to eat food. A number of studies have shown that you run a risk. Now, is the risk high? Well, the risk is high if it's your baby, right? If you're feeding solid foods too soon, the risk is high because you shouldn't be doing that. And number two, you're taking away from the more important nutrient, which is breast milk. And if it's not breast milk and you're in formula, you're getting away from the more important nutrient, which is formula. And so the CDC has come out and said, wait a minute, our data now shows 4 out of 10 moms are introducing solid foods before the age of 6 months, and this really isn't good because it takes away from the nutrition of milk.
Yeah, and they say that some of this is going on, maybe a lot of this is going on, because of the advice from docs.
Oh, I'm sure that's from the advice. That may exactly be the case. You mean the doctors are saying,
go ahead.
Introduce.
Go
ahead.
Yeah.
Well, that's very important. In other words, we have to then maybe re-educate physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, all of whom care for young mothers, on the fact that breast is best for 6 months and a formula for 6 months. Do that exclusively. Now, when I first started practice, we started introducing eggs at 1 week of age. We would say, feed the baby a little pablum, put a little egg yolk in the pablum because of egg allergies. Mm. And it turned out that ended up being more likely to cause egg allergies at a very young age. So I think that we have to tailor our message about breastfeeding for 6 months of age, breastfeeding and formula for 6 months of age, and have to give the same spiel, if you will, over and over again, and no solid foods until 6 months. At the 6 month birthday, you can do it. But 40% is a big mother. So obviously, the physicians aren't getting the message, and neither are the parents.
800-462-7413. Let's get back to the phones now, Zorba. A listener with us now in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zorba and Tom. It's a thrill to talk to you today. Here's my question.
Sure.
Over the last few years, there's been this huge campaign to reduce transmission of germs by stressing hand washing, use of hand sanitizer, you know, coughing into the elbow, and regular sanitizing of common areas. Do you know of any research that shows a significant reduction in the transmission of contagious diseases as a result?
Mm-hmm. Zorba will certainly answer your question. I'm curious, though, on the thrill meter, where do we fall?
Oh, way up there. Way up there.
I'm sort of guessing you've led a sheltered life.
That is very, very good, Tom. Well, you bring up a really, really good point, because there's a lot of issues about this from a couple of different viewpoints. The first viewpoint is maybe we're developing superbugs because we're sanitizing things too much. You know, we know from an evolutionary point of view, if we kill the common bugs, the ones that are more super are more likely to live and then reproduce and carry on, if you will. And so that's one issue, that the over-sanitization is actually producing bugs that we're less likely to be able to kill, with that one thing. We know that that in the food industry, sanitizing counters, sanitizing your hands is very important. And the reason is because one person can then infect a bunch of other people. Right, you've got somebody, we'll say it's Subway, and they're making subs, and you know, in the morning rush, and if they don't essentially keep their hands clean, and they've got something on their hands, they've gone to the washroom, they haven't done normal stuff that we do in the washroom, and clean their hands, they're more likely to spread disease. So, from a bathroom point of view, that's important. In other words, we know that the data's out there, the feds have looked at it, and there are studies that have been done, and in fact, getting doctors to take care of their hands in between patients in the hospital turns out to be an issue because it turns out it doesn't happen all the time. Now, getting to your thing, are we overdoing it? 100%. 100%. I see people walking around these with Purell, and they put Purell in their hands, and they're careful when they open the door, and they're careful when they get a cup of coffee. And I go, what a way to live your life, thinking about these germs that are going to infect you. And I think sometimes they wash their hands and walk across the street, and they'll be killed by a car because they're so busy looking at their hands. So, yeah, I think outside of a hospital environment and medical office environment, we're doing too much. And I think the data is weak. I agree with you. So how often do you wash your hands?
Well, you know, in an office environment, you know, I've got my sanitizer there, and I go over to the copy machine, and I use it where everybody else has been using it and coughing.
Yeah.
And I go back, and I quickly do my hands, and I just wonder after a while if it's like the garlic around the neck in the old days.
You know what? I lecture a lot. I'm going to use that. It's the garlic around the neck. Thank you so much. I've got such a medieval image, you know, of these dirty friars walking through medieval Europe with garlic around their neck to weird off the vapors that kill them. No, you're correct. In an office environment, give it up. Now, sneezing not into your hand, unless you wash it or use a sanitizer, is important, very important, because we know that you've got germs when you're sneezing, and a lot of the germs are coming from your lungs, you know. And I find that so difficult because my mother taught me to sneeze into my hand. I remember, don't sneeze into your sleeve. And when I see people sneeze into their sleeve, image of my mother comes up each and every time, and I've had great difficulty with that. I don't know about you. Do you sneeze into your sleeve or into your hand?
You know, I try to have a Kleenex nearby, so I sneeze into a Kleenex. But I guess I would probably then sanitize my hand if I was going to go into a public space.
So you know what? Give up the sanitizer on the way
really?
To the yes. You don't really have to do it. It's really okay. And there's no evidence that you're spreading that people are spreading bugs that way. You're not going to get. When was the last time you were sick?
It's been a long time.
See? And I think it is like the garlic around your neck. You're looking at the hand sanitizer and saying it keeps me well. But it's not necessary. It's not necessary.
Yeah. It becomes a little neurotic, doesn't it?
It becomes a little OCD neurotic, yes.
Yes.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Appreciate the call. Thanks.
I have to have one final comment on this. I don't know if you've noticed, but you can buy hand sanitizers in the store that actually come on a string that go around your neck so you can keep it around your neck all the time. So it is like the garlic in old days.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. And before we take a short break, Zorba, time now for you to grab your gavel for another case of Judge Zorba. Today's case comes to us from Chuck in O'Fallon, Missouri. He writes, "Hi, Tom and Zorba. I come for your sage insights to settle a difference between my sister and I. I am 62 years old, and I recently got serious about my health. My maintenance program includes a 4-mile walk before work and another 3-mile walk at lunch. On weekends, I walk a bit more, and I lift weights twice a week. My sister says that walking less than 25 miles a week is healthy, but that any more than that causes heart problems. I think my slightly overweight sister just wants to justify not walking herself. You be the judge. I will abide by your advice."
Well, I will take my gavel, which I now have in my hand, and I'm going to make the sound that a gavel makes. Are you ready?
Ready.
Here we go. "I have ruled that his sister is wrong. You can walk as many miles as you want to per week, and you're not going to do any harm to your heart. In fact, you will benefit your heart. The more you walk, the more aerobic exercise we do, generally the way that it is. Now, I'm not going to say that your overweight sister is doing this to simply tell you that you're doing too much because she doesn't want to do as much. Gosh, I would not ever say that, but she is wrong."
Have a scuffle that needs setting? Go the extra mile by sending your case along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have a yummy recipe coming up. good for you, too. Lots more of your calls, some interesting research to talk over, and, of course, our medical myth buster, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, it is recipe time, mango shrimp and brie quesadillas.
You know, I love this recipe. I mean, think about it. Mango. Do you like mangoes?
I do.
I love them. And I have a little mango. I've got a little thing that, it's got that big seed in the middle of the mango. A pit in the middle of the mango. Mm-hmm. And I've got a de-pitter that is wonderful. And if I can find it at home, in fact, I will find it at home. I'll bring it in and I'm going to put a picture of it on our website. The mango de-pitter for people made by, I don't remember the name of the company, but I'll put that on the website too so people can do it. I love shrimp.
Shrimp are good.
Don't you love shrimp?
Brie's a pretty good cheese.
What else could be wrong? A quesadilla, it's great. Yeah. And this is a low-fat recipe. So it's a good example of a low-fat recipe that you can use. I like this because it's got fruit in it, which is great, and it has seafood in it. We should eat more seafood. 2 servings of seafood or fish a week have been shown to reduce heart disease and stroke. I mean, that's part of the Mediterranean diet. And brie cheese is very satisfying. Use it in the right amounts, and it's tasty.
Okay.
Let's get on with the recipe. 1 tablespoonful of extra virgin olive oil. That's the only olive oil I use.
Big T olive oil.
That's right. And I love different ways I would try different kinds of extra virgin olive oil. I go to a variety of stores, and I buy different bottles. Some are more robust than others. So
really?
They're not. They don't.
They are all the same?
No. And if you dip, we'll say, a good piece of French bread in the olive oil, you will taste the differences, or simply taste it on a spoon. They vary all over the place. Trader Joe's is one of the places I shop, and I went there and I bought, I think they have 4 or 5 different kinds of olive oil, and there was a huge difference in the taste of different kinds of olive oil, so pick one you like.
Oh, interesting.
Pick one you like. 10 medium shrimp thawed.
10 medium shrimp thawed.
Unless you happen to live in Louisiana and you can give live shrimp. I don't live in Louisiana. Boy, I like their cooking, don't you? In fact, I think of Louisiana, I think of music and food.
Yeah.
And then I think of alcoholism and
murders.
And murders, that's right. But the food and the music override the alcoholism and the murders. Yeah.
Small red onion diced.
1/2 teaspoon of cumin.
Half a little tea cumin.
So I will always give my cumin tip. Do not buy cumin in a mainstream grocery store because it is a high-value item to there, and they cost much, much more. Go to a Hispanic grocery store, Indian grocery store, Asian grocery store, and you will find cumin is very cheap. But in mainstream grocery stores, they often charge $3 or $4 a bottle for something that costs 79 cents in an Asian grocery store.
Okay.
1/2 teaspoon of ground ginger, or fresh ginger rather, much better than ground ginger. So 1/2 teaspoon of fresh ginger, which you grate.
Okay, 1/2 tea ginger.
That's right. Now, depending on how hot you like it, and I know you are some like it hot of a person.
Yeah, you too. I know.
Serrano chili or 2 jalapeno chilies minced.
Serrano chili or 2 jalapeno chili minced.
Immediately wash your hands in the sink and make sure you get all of that hot pepper off, because if you scratch your eyes, you will damn the recipe.
Okay.
1/4 teaspoon of salt.
1/4 little tea salt.
Okay. You're going to use 8-inch tortillas. I often go for the low carb, and if you look at it, it's actually a low carb tortilla. It's a little bit thinner, has 80 to 120 calories versus some of the tortillas which can have 180 to 250 calories.
So 4 8-inch low-carb tortillas.
Right. That's what I recommend. A ripe mango peeled and sliced. If you don't have access to a mango because it's not the season, you could use a papaya. You could use peach. You could use a pear.
Okay. One ripe One of those things.
That's right. One of those things. Yeah. A half a cup of lightly packed cilantro leaves. Cut their stems and remove them.
Half a cup of lightly packed fresh cilantro leaves. Chopped stems.
That's right. 8 ounces of brie. If you want to go low fat, which is what we're doing, use light brie because you're going to basically light brie is okay to use in the recipe. If you don't want to, you could use regular brie and just save those calories somewhere else.
8 ounces of light brie sliced into long quarter-inch slices.
That's right. A 1/4 cup of plain fat-free yogurt. Greek yogurt has more protein and has more taste to it.
A 1/4 cup plain fat-free yogurt.
Dan, did you know that Greek yogurt is on the rise and is eating into the regular yogurt industry? They're made by the same companies. Tremendous. Go to the store and look at yogurt, and you will see that there's more and more Greek yogurt out. People like the tang of the taste. Hmm. 2 tablespoons of freshly squeezed lime juice. Do not use reconstituted. It's not going to taste the same.
2 big tea, freshly squeezed lime juice.
1/4 teaspoon salt.
1/4 little tea salt.
So let's make the recipe. Heat a 10-inch nonstick saute pan. Very important that it's nonstick because then you're going to be able to use less oil. Add the oil that we're using, which is 1 tablespoonful. Mm-hmm. Saute the shrimp, onion, cumin, garlic, and chilies and salt together until the shrimp is cooked. It's not going to take very long. If your shrimp is at room temperature, it might take a minute or 2 minutes. If you overcook the shrimp, it will taste mealy, which isn't as good. Mm-hmm. Place 1 tortilla in a dry pan, 1 minute on each side, just until it turns brown. Remove it. Repeat with the 2nd tortilla. If your tortilla puffs up, poke it with a fork to remove the air. Sometimes they do puff up. Mm-hmm. After the 2nd tortilla is browned, leave it in the pan. Reduce the heat to medium-low and spread half the mango evenly over the top of the tortilla and then top with half the shrimp mixture and half the brie strips. And then put the tortilla, that other tortilla you put to the side, on top. Cover the pan with the lid. Reduce the heat to medium. Do it for 2 minutes so the brie is going to melt. Then flip the tortilla with a spatula. Recover the pan 2 more minutes. Don't worry if there's a little cheese that escapes in that. Mm-hmm. Then remove the quesadilla from the pan. Let it sit for a minute and slice it into 8 wedges, kind of like a pizza. Then repeat it with the remaining ingredients. The remaining tortillas serve immediate and dip it into the yogurt dipping sauce, which is that plain yogurt with a little lime juice in there. It is delicious. 230 calories per serving. Not much at all. It's wonderful.
It sounds pretty complicated, hard to do.
You know what? It's not complicated when you look at it on paper. And I've got a recommendation. You can find this on paper through your smartphone or your computer by coming to our website at zorbapastor.org. You can find this recipe. You can look at our other recipes. You can see pictures of Tom and I. We look dynamite on that website. You're now smiling.
I'm cringing.
You're cringing at what you're doing. Yeah. That's zorbapastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener with us now in New Berlin, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I'm concerned about the reports of cancer-causing ingredients in sunscreen. And, of course, we're encouraged to slather it on to prevent cancer. Can you comment on this?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, first of all, there's no evidence there are cancer-causing ingredients in sunscreen. So I think whatever – I'm going to poo-poo that data because I think it's junk science. There's no science behind that. And we've been using sunscreen for years. Now, given that, there are some people, a number of people, that move against PABA containing sunscreen, which is the most common sunscreen, and they move to Parasol. I can't remember the number. It's called Parasol 56. It's got some number after the name Parasol, which is another ingredient in sunscreen, because the PABA may cause skin irritation and other irritation problems,
but not cancer.
I don't think it causes cancer at all. We have other issues with sunscreen, but as I said, the PABA is the cheaper one, and the Parasol ones are more expensive. But I don't think there's any evidence. I want to talk a little bit about risk in that, because risk makes a lot of sense. Do you drive? Do you drive your car?
Sure.
Okay. Do you drive when it's dark outside?
Yes.
Of course. Do you drive in the rain?
Yes.
Sure. Do you drive in the rain when it's dark outside? Sure, of course.
Yes.
And if the road is super icy, let's assume you're up in the hinterlands of the UP, you know, and you're on a new road and it's super icy, you're not going to go outside unless you really have to, you know, because there's a higher risk. So there are risks that we accept within society, and they're generally, you know, we drive at night and it's not as easy as during the day, and we mm-hmm. drive when it's rainy outside, but we're more careful. So if we look on the risk stratification, you have the risk of skin cancer that we know is really there. We know basal cell skin cancer, which is common, is there and really common. And we know melanoma is there. And we know that risk is reduced by sunscreen. And then we have the theoretical risk of what some of the components may have within the sunscreen. And then we make a decision one way or another. And I think that's the way to look at it. It is possible that some of their science is correct. But I think if there is a risk, and our FDA looks at it all the time, and they haven't come in on it, I'll sit with the FDA and I'll look at the risk of black mole skin cancer, and I'll weigh it against this possible risk of what's in the sunscreen. And I'll make a decision. And for me, the decision is, what sunscreen do I like the feel of best? Mm-hmm. So I'll actually use it. And I think that's the way to kind of bird dog it, you know, to look at it in that way. You know what, you follow what I'm saying? That's, and look at it as a risk that we take in our normal society of driving in the car. Because that's a risk that we all accept, because we have to do it and we like to do it. So
yes. Well, thank you very much.
Sure. Good luck, and thanks for your call.
We appreciate it. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And time now, Zorba, for another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. On a recent show, Zorba, we had a caller concerned about the carbon monoxide she found in her salmon. You mentioned that it might be used to suffocate the fish, but a whole school of listeners disagree. Kurt in Madison, Wisconsin, speaks for many when he writes this. I hate to disagree with the doctor, but you must be thinking of carbon dioxide, which displaces oxygen and suffocates a person. Carbon monoxide ties up the hemoglobin, giving the flesh a reddish tinge. It may be used to pass off pale-colored farm-raised salmon for more expensive wild salmon, which is generally a deeper pink color.
I think they're right, and I was wrong. There's no doubt about it. I was thinking, first of all, carbon monoxide will also suffocate a fish, just as carbon dioxide will suffocate a fish. But carbon monoxide gives the fish the red color. It never occurred to me, because humans who die of carbon monoxide poisoning will have a red color to their face. So that's very interesting that they use this to take a pale fish and make it look pink, because we associate the pink fish with a healthy fish that we are then consuming. So kudos to them, and thank you, listeners, for chiming in on, once again, another error in my life.
If Zorba's red herring has led you astray, send us back on track by sending an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have some more research coming up, as you know, Zorba. We have our medical myth buster a little later. Some more of your calls, too. Good reasons to stay with us right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before we get back to the phones, there's some new info on chelation therapy.
That's right, chelation therapy. Now, chelation therapy has been around forever. It's been around probably for 50 years. And the idea behind it is that there's something called EDTA, and EDTA is an intravenous chemical pharmaceutical that we use mm-hmm. to leach lead out of the body. So if you have lead poisoning, you get EDTA infused into you to help leach lead out of the body. And then the theory back in the 50s and 60s and 70s was that this will leach cholesterol out of the body.
Yeah.
And I've been against chelation therapy years.
You've strongly opposed
to
what's
it.
New?
It's very expensive. It's alternative therapy, and there's no science behind it that's useful, junk science. So the National Institute of Health decided to put behind it a lot of money to study whether or not it did anything. And JAMA recently published an article. Mm-hmm. The bottom line showed that EDTA therapy, which, by the way, is never covered by your insurance and costs a ton, and you've got to get a bunch of intravenous injections, and I can't remember if it's 25 or 30 on this particular study, but it's right around that number, once a week, produced a very, very small difference. In other words, it actually was shown to be possibly beneficial for people with heart disease. Now, let me explain how small the difference is.
Yeah.
The difference is probably equivalent to eating one serving of fish a week in terms of the reduction of heart disease. In other words, chelation therapy or a tuna sandwich.
Yeah. Which one is cheaper
equivalent.
For one thing?
Which one is cheaper? So, I mean, in other words, a very small difference, very small difference. Now, there was an accompanying editorial looking at this because a lot of practitioners, alternative practitioners, are going to use this study and say, see, chelation therapy works. Give me your $10,000 and I'll get rid of your arterial sclerosis. Mm-hmm. And so they went through a whole issue of whether or not we should publish this. And the editorial talks about the fact that it's important science because it proved A – maybe there the A, it proved significantly there was a tiny, tiny difference. And B, it showed it wasn't a significant difference enough so that we should use it. And finally, we're finally tested this correctly. So the editorial talked about it. But the fact is, it's a tiny, tiny difference versus nothing. But that tiny difference isn't worth very much.
You think there'll be a surge now again?
Oh, there'll be a surge of advertising, of course. And there'll be a surge of a number of what I still consider to be alternative practitioners that I would not trust, who are going to give this very expensive therapy for not very much of a benefit. But we have to let science have its due. The benefit is teeny tiny. The benefit is small. And if you're going to do it, I would recommend you think twice and maybe just have an extra serving of fish instead.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, our next caller, is in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Zorba.
How can we help?
I have a question about diet and supplements. I know that you both are advocates of the Mediterranean diet, and you know, I think everybody agrees that the best source of vitamins and minerals and omegas are, you know, from our foods. But realistically, we don't always get, you know, we don't always eat right. And so my question is, you know, what is your recommendation about supplementation? I read articles that say vitamins are good for you, some that say they're not. You know, there's all the – I just read an article the other day about all the odd omegas, you know, 3, 5, 7, 9. I just think that we can all agree on what our diet should be, but it just seems to get murkier when you start talking about what additional things you, you know, supplements you should use, if any. So
yes.
I was hoping maybe you could clarify.
Yes. There's money behind this. In other words,
right,
when
exactly.
you look at the supplement industry, and one year it's $2 billion, and the next year it's $3 billion, and the next year it's $5 billion, and then you look at companies that sell supplements, you look at it in grocery stores and convenience stores because basically it makes a lot of money, and
mm-hmm.
And under FDA rules, you can't claim it cures a disease, but you can claim it's good for your health, and the FDA regulates supplements in the same fashion that they regulate cosmetics.
Wow.
So in other words, use this cream, you'll be 10 years younger. So
mm-hmm.
supplements can say, use this cream and you'll increase your vitality. And they can say that. Or it's good for prostate health, even though there's no science behind it. And you, as a buyer, may say, well, if it's advertised, there must be some science behind it. And then they'll say, well, studies have shown. Of course, they don't tell you that they're not double-blind placebo-controlled mm-hmm. studies. They just did a study of 10 people, and so they make their claim. But given that, there are some minimum supplements that I take. So I take a multivitamin. regular multivitamin, a Centrum generic that I take, and I take a generic versus a name brand because I am, Tom, anybody?
Cheap and thrifty.
Cheap and thrifty. So you can either use the name brand. And
okay.
It doesn't take much for Tom to say cheap and thrifty. I don't consider that to be an insult. That's, you know.
No, not at all. I think a lot of people would. Yeah. That's how I consider myself that.
There we go. It's an accolade that I like to
and
have.
And frugal.
Well, frugal might be a little bit too far down the line.
You take offense at frugal?
Yeah, I'm taking offense at frugal. That's it. It might be a little bit too much. So a multivitamin, that's number one I take. Then number two, I recommend vitamin D. There's not enough in a multivitamin. There's a lot of data out there that show that higher D levels are better for you. Now, it's a chicken and egg thing. We don't know. There's some long-term studies going on. So I recommend 1 or 2,000 units of D. 1,000 works, 2,000 also works. Choose which one, whichever one is cheaper. That's what I would get. Vitamin D. The other supplement that I recommend for many people are calcium, but I don't recommend high dose calcium anymore. I recommend a minimum of probably 750 to 1,000 milligrams of calcium a day. I recommend that you try to get half of that from dairy. A container of yogurt is roughly 400 milligrams. Dairy calcium is absorbed differently in the body than chalk calcium, which is what we get. There's good data that seems to show that there's a difference there. But I don't recommend 2,000 milligrams anymore, and I don't recommend the 1,000 milligram tablets that I used to take because the data shows that may increase the risk of heart attacks because the calcium levels in the body shoot up too much. And that's it.
I
used to take fish oil. I don't take it because the data shows it doesn't work. Some people take it for their arthritis, and it may work for that. I don't take vitamin E. I used to take it, but the data shows that it doesn't work. I used to take folic acid, but the data shows that it doesn't work, and so I don't take it. I used to take antioxidants, but the data shows get it from food, don't get it from pills. So that's what I spend.
Okay. Now, aren't we supposed to take D in conjunction with calcium? Is it something about absorbing
Not at all. I don't think there's any data.
Okay.
I think they just put D in calcium because it sells better. And also we need more D, and there's not enough in a multivitamin. And some people will say, what about magnesium? Get it from food. And if you don't get it from food, take a teaspoon of milk of magnesia. It's good for your bowels. And we have to remember that people over 50, when you look at constipation, there's a ratio. People 50 years of older, constipation to a 50-year-old is like sex to a 16-year-old. They think about it all the time. So if you want a little more magnesium, take some milk of magnesia at night.
Milk of magnesia. Yeah.
That's
okay.
Right. Teaspoon. That's all you need.
And is there any difference for men versus – I mean, your recommendation is whether male or female.
I don't think it makes a difference. I think it's a cell. You know, this is a male vitamin. That's a female vitamin.
Right.
This vitamin is pink label. That vitamin has a blue label. It's red state, green state, blue state, yellow state. You know, I don't think
all
it matters.
All right. Doesn't matter what the – okay. All right. Terrific.
So.
And
now,
then the omegas that we get, we just will get whatever in our generic –
Right. Now, I do want to make a comment. For a menstruating female, you need to have iron. So for a younger woman who's menstruating, a vitamin that contains iron is useful because a woman loses iron through menstruation. But once a woman stops menstruating, I don't think there's any difference. So good
All right,
luck.
Terrific.
Save your money. Right. Spend it in the grocery store.
Perfect. Sounds good.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you so very much. Yeah, very, very helpful. I appreciate it.
Excellent.
I enjoy listening.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And if you're over 60 – and think of something other than
constipation
all the time. You can email Zorba.
At Zorba@WPR.org and tell me what's in your thought right now if you're over 60 and you're not worried about constipation.
Time now, Zorba, for our medical myth buster. And this week we're taking one from a listener named Bubalua in Madison, Wisconsin. Bubalua.
That's right. It's a name you'll never forget.
Name.
That's right.
Bubalua here with everyone's favorite family doc, Zorba Pester. Bubalua recently read an article claiming that if a man or woman can go from sitting to standing with only using one hand, or even better, without any help from any hands, then they have a higher chance of survival than those who can't. What do you think, Zorba? Am I doomed?
Well, there. First of all,
I'm not doomed because I don't have to use my hands to get up.
No, you're doomed. Well, it's interesting. There are some studies that show it's sort of a crude measurement of physical fitness. So if you can get off the ground without using your hand, you're more likely to be physically fit. And therefore, there are a whole bunch of other things that follow with that. You may be eating right, exercising. You're more likely to live longer. However, some people have osteoarthritis and they're still physically fit. And they can't get up or they have had knee surgery. So it's a crude measurement that may work. And there's some people say that we docs should take people who are 50 or 60 and over and have them sit on the ground in our office. I wouldn't do that because we've got, you know, it's not a clean floor.
Yeah.
And then see if they can sit up, and that's a measurement. But as a crude measurement, it does have some meaning to it. But like you said, I mean, I've got wrist arthritis, and I may use my hands to get up, and my back hurts me a little bit. So am I doomed? No, I'm not doomed, and you're not doomed either. Can you get up from the floor without using your hands?
I'm pretty sure I can. I don't know if I've really tried to.
Well, you'll have to go home and see if you can get off the floor. And
I could try it now, but it's not a very good visual.
It's not a good radio visual. So we're not.
I'll give it a try.
Yeah, okay.
Think your myth can stand up to Zorba scrutiny, then send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
To the phones again we go. Zorba, a listener with us in Tiburon, California. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my question.
Sure. What's up?
I was wondering if there are any negative side effects to taking 10 milligrams of Pepcid AC daily on a long-term basis. The reason for my question is that in December, my 14-year-old dog, Tigger, and I rescued a puppy from the local Humane Society whose name is Rosie, and she's now 6 months old.
Mm-hmm.
Tigger always seems anxious around Rosie, especially in the mornings, so I'll usually give Tigger a Pepcid first thing in the morning before she has her breakfast. But then this slow process starts of me trying to get finicky and picky Tigger, and she's listening and looking at me, to eat, which upsets me and my stomach, so I take a Pepcid too. Some mornings, actually like this morning, I just automatically take a Pepcid with Tigger since I know what lies ahead of me. Sometimes it takes her 4 hours to pick through her breakfast. Anyway, the Pepcid box says don't take the pill for more than 14 days. So again, I was wondering, what are the negative side effects for both of us?
You're a real Winnie the Pooh fan, aren't you?
Yes, clearly you are. And Tom and I both have dogs, so we can certainly relate to it.
Yeah.
We certainly relate to this, you know, Tigger and Rosie. Well, first of all, offhand, I am not a vet, so I'm not going to talk about Tigger and the Pepcid. The reason why the FDA puts that on there is a CYA label. Do you know what CYA is?
Yes, I do. Cover your rear end.
Yeah. And that's because
I'm an attorney, so I understand especially.
I'm talking to the right person, but I better be careful with my words. But the reason why they do that is basically if it's more than 14 days, they want people to sort of see from their doc is something else going on. And that's the reason. It's not that there are any side effects. There are people who take Pepcid and have taken it every day for 20 years or 30 years. And in fact, Pepcid and Zantac, which are the two premier drugs in that class as generics, and generics are just as good as name brand, are really better than taking Prilosec and Prevacid, which are called proton pumps inhibitors. And those we now worry about because they may interfere with calcium absorption and magnesium absorption in the long run. So we were giving that because they're more powerful, but on the whole, they're not really as safe in the long run. So I think 10 milligrams of Pepcid is just fine. It's okay for you to take in the morning before you even approach Tigger with the fact that she and Rosie are going to have to interact. Have you talked to Tigger about this problem and tried to get her to kind of wise up to Rosie? Have you been able to do any dog whispering at all?
On a daily basis. And she had been the lady of the house and
yes.
the only one here before Rosie came. And so I think it just disrupted her. So we do daily talk, and she comes with me everywhere, but unfortunately now Rosie does too.
Yeah, so. Well, that's just how it is when you have a second child. The first one just has to adjust.
Well, this is so so helpful. We're so excited we can keep taking our Pepcid. So
yes,
thank you so
yes,
much.
You can. You're welcome. Thanks for your call.
Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Sure enjoy listening to you. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. And before we step away for the week, Zorba, we have a special package to open. Tom and Larry, the duo behind a company called Tasty Kale in Woodbridge, Connecticut, sent us some kale to taste. They know that you're a fan of the so-called superfood, so they thought you might like it in chip form. And here we have it right in front of us.
We have it. So I've got
four different kinds.
That's right. We're going to try them. I have garlic and sweet. So first I'm going to try garlic. What do you have in front of you?
I have the natural, I guess, and the spicy.
Okay. So you want to start out. Why don't you start out with the natural?
With the natural?
The natural.
Okay.
Yeah, start out with that, and then I'll do the garlic.
Because I think I've mentioned in the show, I'm not sure whether I like kale
Or you'll find out. Take a taste. How is it?
It's
You're
very
smiling.
Good.
Smiling.
Okay, very good.
Okay, I'm going to try the garlic. I like it.
Yeah.
Like a chip.
Like kale. Okay.
I guess so.
I'm so
what are you? What are you doing? You're doing
spicy.
Spicy. Spicy curry. Spicy curry.
Oh yeah, spicy curry.
Mm-hmm. How is it?
Very good.
You're good? Okay, I'm going to do sweet. I don't associate kale with sweet. Let me see.
Kale's pretty good stuff.
You know what? It's pretty good. And what's interesting, let me get the label out here to look at what it is. If we look at this box of kale, and it's a really nice size.
These are good snacks.
If we look at it, they have good snacks. If we look at the number of calories that are on here, I've got to look for the calories. They're sort of, I think they're underneath the box. Number of calories are basically 110 to 130 calories for a container. Very satisfying. Far fewer calories than chips. Quite delicious, and of course, it has the benefits of kale. I don't know if I would call it a superfood, but it certainly is a green food, dark green, so it's filled with vitamins, and it's something I'm going to eat today, and I think it's great, and we will put it, picture of it, on our website.
Well, I get half of it for me, too.
You get half of it for you. There we go. So if you come to our website at zorbapastor.org, we'll show some pictures of the kale, and you can see a picture of me munching on the kale.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
And you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. This show is produced by Gabrielle Pedriani. Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich. And our technical director this time, Brittany True. Good job, Brittany. Our theme music is by Leon Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0413Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.